Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello. You're listening to BFN. This is the podcast about infertility, IVF, and the trials of trying for a baby. I'm Emma.
And I'm Gabby, and we're two card-carrying members of the Infertility Club.
Hello.
Hi guys.
Hey guys.
What's up? Happy Tuesday.
I'm feeling really sexy.
You're feeling really sexy?
I don't know why I'm doing that voice. I just started like this, so I will continue.
Well, you mentioned wine there. Have you already opened it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, God, you're already in the mood. Jesus.
Yeah, I'm in a
throw
wine.
Throw a bucket of icy water on Emma, quick.
I don't think I'm in the mood. I'm in the mood for wine.
In the mood for something.
Yeah. Well, I had my second COVID vaccine.
COVID.
I've been COVID.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm actually not in the mood for a lot.
When was that again?
It was on Friday.
Yeah. And you didn't feel any weirdness afterwards, did you?
I did a bit on Saturday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I got the shivers and also started spotting.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I know. I was really like, what?
Yeah. It's very hormonal, isn't it?
Is it?
It has an impact on your hormones, yeah.
Yeah, I think it does. But not fertility, just to be clear about
it. Yes, of course.
It doesn't have an impact on your fertility. But it did make me bleed a bit, so that was quite interesting. Or maybe it didn't make me bleed a bit, because as we know, correlation is not causation. It could be that I just started spotting, but I haven't spotted for a really long time. So,
yeah.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Didn't someone say in an interview, they were like, if it does impact your fertility, it would only be for like one cycle.
Yeah.
Because hormones can fluctuate.
Yeah, and I think it does impact men's, not, sorry, the vaccine doesn't, COVID itself does impact men's sperm health. But I think they've kind of found that it's not for a prolonged period, it's for a kind of small amount of time, like a few months.
Okay, so it's like, what, because you've got 3 months, haven't you?
Yeah.
And then your sperm regenerates again, so...
Oh, you're such a sperm expert.
I mean, they don't call me the sperm woman for nothing.
Do they call you the sperm woman?
No one has ever called me the sperm woman.
Here comes the sperm woman.
Floating the idea myself.
I don't think that you should be called the sperm woman.
Here she comes.
Jizzy McGee.
Jizzy G. Oh my God. You can call me Jizzy G.
Now that's what we're going to call you. It's a much better name.
Oh dear. I've got some jizzy plans coming up, actually, which I haven't revealed yet. But yeah. Maybe that's going to be my Jizzy G will be the name. Lol.
I'm looking forward to that because there's a logo.
Yes, there is a logo. Guys, I'm going to do some sperm content on my Instagram.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure when is the problem. I think probably September, but I will all be revealed very soon.
Just to be very clear after that, in summary of that conversation, there's no studies showing that the COVID vaccine has an impact on fertility. There are studies showing that COVID itself has an impact on male fertility.
For a short period. Okay, glad to get that covered up.
That's now off my chest. I actually wanted to talk about something very briefly today, which is, did you know that this weekend was the 101st birthday of a woman called Henrietta Lacks?
No.
No. I didn't know anything about her. And then I saw Broken Brown Egg, who we've interviewed before, talk about it. And it's like an amazing story. Basically, it was like 6 a.m. and I just got obsessed with the Wikipedia page and then started reading all about it. But she was a woman in the 1950s who got cervical cancer. And she had samples of her cells taken from her body. She was biopsied, as people with cancer are. Mm-hmm. But the biopsy was then taken and... they found that her cells were basically amazing at reproducing and staying alive for a very long time. And they've been described as immortal cells.
Wow. Jesus.
And they grew them in Petri dishes, and they're called HeLa cells, and they're still used today without her permission at all, which is the kind of insane part of this story. And they've informed a whole load of medical research, but one of the parts of medical research that they've informed is IVF.
Wow.
And I would just, firstly, happy birthday, Henrietta.
She's still alive?
No, she died of cancer, aged 30, I think, like in her early 30s. Wow. It's a really sad story. And her, you know, her family has taken years to kind of get the kind of the recognition that it deserves, or that she deserves for her. But it's just an amazing story and worth a Google.
It's incredible. I'm absolutely looking at this Wikipedia page as soon as I get off the phone.
Yeah.
Are we on the phone?
We are, aren't we? Yeah. We're not looking at each other.
No, sadly.
So I just wanted to talk about Henrietta because she is a woman who deserves a bit of recognition.
Well,
and it's her 101st birthday, and let's just all celebrate by Googling her.
What a ledge.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Thanks for bringing this to everyone's attention and mine.
Okay. should we talk about the show?
Yeah, let's do it.
Today we are interviewing Krina Diman.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she's talking about cancer too.
She is talking about cancer, yeah. Among a lot of other things. This woman has an amazing story.
Uh-huh. So she talked about cancer, she talked about heart failure, and she talked about having multiple children via surrogacy.
Yep.
It's an amazing story. She hosts co-hosts a surrogacy podcast called The Intended Parent.
Mm-hmm.
Which is it's on all good podcast platforms, and you can find out more on Instagram at The Intended Parent.
Yeah, she's really, really lovely as well.
Yeah, she's really lovely. And because she was so lovely and her story is so amazing, has so many twists and turns, I kind of did very little editing on it.
It's long.
Yeah, which means it's really long, but I mean, it's definitely worth a listen.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Before that, Liz is on the line.
Liz is on the line.
She first of all, sounds like there's an orchestra in the background. Like, I love the emotional places she takes us.
She really does. For anyone who's not listened to this before, Liz is our BFN agony aunt,
mm-hmm.
Who is answering your deepest, darkest emotional infertility questions.
Yeah.
At the proms.
Yeah. The person whose question she's answering has had a really hard year, and is saying, how do you keep going doing fertility treatment?
Mm, good question.
So I think
it's
one for us all to listen to, frankly.
She's not going to answer that one, surely. How is Liz going to answer that? She finds a way.
She is good.
She is good. When you're good, you're good.
When you're good, you're good.
Yeah. And that's it, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy the show.
Yeah, and while you're enjoying the show, mm-hmm. please rate and review it because it helps other people to find it.
Please do.
In the meantime, you can also find us on Instagram.
At Big Fat Negative.
And Twitter.
At Big Fat Negative.
And by the way, I do have Twitter in front of me all day. So if anybody wants to tweet and like have a chat, please do. Because, you know, sometimes I just want to tweet all day.
Yeah, Emma loves a tweet.
Yeah, especially if anyone wants to talk about Love Island.
Oh my God, I want to fucking talk about Love Island.
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts on that. And if anybody wants a tweet at Big Fat Negative about their thoughts on Love Island, then just I'm there.
I mean, that is a definitely an off-topic subject for our Twitter. But yeah. I suppose, fuck it.
It's an open
invite. Well, no, because I want to get involved and I'm never on Twitter. So if we're doing any Love Island chat, can it happen on Instagram? Because then I will be there.
Sure.
Maybe we should do a show. We should do an Instagram live about Love Island.
If there are any Love Island people who listen to us, we'd love to hear you.
Oh my God, story. Yeah. Have you been on Love Island? Yeah. Are you now struggling with your fertility?
We'll talk about fertility for maybe 4 minutes, and then the rest of the time we'll be talking about Love Island.
Do you know what I was thinking the other day? I really want to know how it works. Like, I want to speak to someone who is behind the scenes on Love Island who can tell me, like, exactly what's going on.
I've actually got a connection.
Do you?
Yeah. Huh. I've got, no, it's like show? A it's like a friend of a friend. We should make a Love Island podcast.
Oh, I mean, we really shouldn't. I'm definitely not an expert enough. I just love it, and it really interests me.
Anyway,
sorry, guys, it's a big digression.
Can people email us?
Yeah. Please email us bigfatnegativepodcast@gmail.com.
Uh huh. And also, please pre-order our book. It's out in January.
It's such a good book.
It's such a good book, and it's got a lovely cover.
It's got a lovely cover.
I think it would look really nice in anyone's house.
Yeah, I think
it would. If you don't like how it looks, you can turn it round like they do on Instagram. Yeah. And then the like white pages will work well with your neutral decor.
Oh, do they do that on Instagram, do they?
Yeah, loads of people do that.
Oh, I've got a new room to decorate. Maybe I'll try a bit of backwards.
Loads of turned round books, so you can't tell what's...
Isn't the joy of having a bookshelf showing off how clever you are by looking at your books?
Yeah, and like how great you are for pre-ordering the BFN book.
Exactly. You don't want to hide that shit.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll catch you on the other side.
Flip side.
Oh, me again. How are you all? I hope that you're all well. This week we've been written to all the way from New Zealand, and this lady's given us a little bit of background on her story. And unfortunately, following some tests, they discovered that her partner was born with an extremely rare condition that has impacted on his sperm. And you know, she goes on to say that they were very, very fortunate because her partner's brother has agreed to be their sperm donor. And in addition to that, they have been given a series of IUI rounds and an IVF round with the benefit of public funding. Now, they've had two failed IUI rounds and they're about to start on their third. And she writes, "I know that there are many, many ways in which we are incredibly lucky. There's been a clear issue to diagnose. My partner has a loving brother who instantly agreed to be our donor. We have public funding for now. I'm 35 and so in theory have a bit of time. But, and this has prompted my question, I'm really struggling with the fact that we've had two failed rounds and I'm finding it hard to keep myself going. I have quite a high pressure job and almost every area of our lives is under major strain. Unexpected house renovations, my partner's dad is in hospital, my partner is a doctor and has big exams coming up this year, and it feels like we're under siege. So I'm wondering if you have any tips on how to keep positive, how to keep going and not let infertility cloud every aspect of your life." Well, I'm really sorry to hear that you're going through such a difficult time at the moment, and with so many things going on and a pandemic on top of that, I cannot imagine. I mean, there's been so many of us who've gone through treatment during this really, really tough time, and you know, that's those of us who don't have all of the other things that you've experiencing as well. So tips to keep positive. Wow. I mean, as we know, I'm not much of a positive Pam. But what I will say, and the one thing that has kept Nick and I going through our entire journey, if you will, is that we just laugh with each other. Often we just laugh at the absolute ridiculousness of the situation that we find ourselves in. We, like you, have had house renovations going on. Nick's actually currently revising for some exams that he's about to sit, which are, you know, a big deal for him. So I totally understand how you're feeling in terms of just feeling as though everything is just going on at once, and it's so difficult to just keep going, keep putting one foot in front of the other. I suppose on the one hand, it's a bit of a, you know, British keep calm and carry on type job, isn't it, really? Which is, don't get me wrong, that's not my advice. You know, everyone, a lot of us go for that sort of stiff upper lip, because it's almost like once you acknowledge how hard it is, you start to not shut down, but to see all the mud. I don't even know if that makes sense, but you know, when you're just wading through this shit show, and if you don't acknowledge it, it's almost like I can keep going. But once you do recognize it, and it sounds to me that you have very bravely said, do you know what, this is a lot, you then kind of have to make that decision as to what to do. I mean, I don't know whether or not you've considered delaying things. Is that an option? It may not be. I know you said you're 35, so you may be concerned about that. You know, I'm assuming that you've had tests on yourself, and so there's no concerns around your egg quality or anything like that, which is brilliant. I wonder whether or not, yeah, is there anything that you can do to give yourself a bit of breathing space? Have you thought about speaking to your clinic, speaking to your practitioners, to see whether or not there is anything that they can advise in terms of being able to take some of that away? Because it sounds to me that a lot of the other things that are going on are things that you have limited control over. You know, the sort of stressful, high-pressure job. My sister is, you know, a corporate solicitor. Often she has kind of client demands and things on her time, which is very much, you know, out of her control. So her responsibility is to deliver. I don't know if you're in a similar situation. I suspect that you probably are. Your partner sounds as though he's not able really to delay his exams because he wants to get those you know, out of the way, which I completely understand. And obviously with house renovations and all those sorts of things, you have to make the decision that maybe something's got to give just for the minute. Have you spoken with your partner about whether or not there's anything that you can do in terms of delaying treatment? Is that something that you would be prepared to consider, or do you just want to get it out the way? I mean, those are just some sort of thoughts, which is not really the question that you've asked me. You've asked me about staying positive and keeping going. Yeah, and as cheesy as it sounds, my one tip would be laughter. Because, and that is 100% being able to laugh with each other, and also being able to talk with each other. Like, we have had, especially since starting the podcast or thinking about being involved in the podcast, we have had so many more honest conversations with each other about how we kind of truly feel about IVF and everything that's going on. So I think that's the other thing, is having those discussions, having those conversations, if you can, if you've got time, if you've got the space, if you're both receptive to it. And if you're not, find your tribe. Like, do you have friends that you are able to confide in, you're able to speak to, and you are able to lean on for advice, for guidance, for support? Because sometimes you almost need to lean on each other, be that your partner or be that, you know, some close friends and family, in order to just help you to kind of get over the line. It's just so difficult though, isn't it? And it's such a personal experience. And you know, I don't know about you, but I always felt very under pressure because, you know, I'm getting older. I'm 30, I was thinking about this earlier. I'm 38 this year. That's horrific. I mean, it's not, because, you know, if it wasn't for IVF, I don't think I would be even worrying about my age. But it, you do feel very pressured, I think, to sort of keep pushing through with things. And maybe that pressure doesn't have to be there. So is it worth having conversations with medical professionals to find out whether or not there are alternatives, instead of pushing on with treatment? Or does the funding have a sort of specific deadline? In which case, is that a benefit? Because you know when something's going to end. It's almost like you just have to push through to get to this point, and then you know it's, you know that the pressure lifts and eases. But yeah, laugh with each other, speak to each other, and enjoy your time together, because it sounds as though you're both exceptionally busy with work, with family, with house renovations. Do you have time together? How much time do you spend together? Can you, you know, can you sort of take time away to just appreciate being with each other and the life that you currently have and currently enjoy, although it does sound very stressful. But also, if by delaying your next IUI, you can have a bit of a break from IVF, will that help you to clear your mind and get that strength to keep going? I don't know. It's just a thought anyway. But I'm sending you so much strength, and I really hope that something breaks for you guys, because it sounds as though there are a lot of balls in the air right now, and maybe it is worth having that conversation to see if something can just temporarily be put on the back burner. But, you know, in any regard, just talk to each other. Be honest. Talk to each other about your fears. Talk to each other about your dreams, your aspirations, how you want this to go, and figure out a way forward between the two of you, because you are a partnership. And he's there to support you just as much as you're there to support him. And I hope that you take great care of each other, and sending you lots of love. Bye-bye.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Karina, hello.
Hello.
Right, let's start this by asking you the classic question. Karina, tell us about your journey.
It's a super long journey, and I'll try my best to keep it brief. But I guess, you know, the highlights of my journey, if I was doing like a 10-minute summary of it, is that in 2013, at the age of 33, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And that came, you know, obviously that comes with a massive story of its own that anyone can listen to on various other podcasts. But one of the biggest life affecting parts of that cancer diagnosis, aside from the cancer itself, was, I guess, an introduction into infertility for me. And, you know, I sat in my oncologist's room just before having chemotherapy, and he told me that, you know, the drugs I was about to have would potentially damage my ovaries and affect my ability to have children in the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very quickly asked how I felt about parenthood. And, you know, I'm South Asian. I don't think it had ever crossed my mind to not be a mum. I was probably one of those people who pushed a child around in a pushchair from, you know, a really young age and continued to do it, you know, through my teenage years for my younger cousins, and constantly thought about motherhood and when that would happen for me. So, you know, as soon as he asked me the question, there was no hesitation. I was married, and my husband and I both expected to be parents at a point in the future. So, you know, I said to him, look, it's really important that motherhood is an option for me if I survive cancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sort of gave me options on drugs that could help protect my fertility but would not give any guarantee. And at that point in time, I think I was quite naive when it came to the world of motherhood. My conceptions of motherhood were very much a husband and a wife use their sperm and their egg to create a baby. That was all I was aware of, you know, and that's all my community ever spoke of. There was never talk of alternate routes to parenthood. So for me, I said to him, look, I really want to harvest my eggs and create these embryos for future use. If, you know, if we survive this, that's sort of my insurance policy. Mm. And he quite crudely said to me, you know, Karina, my job here is to save your life, not to create a new life. And wow. Those words will never leave me, because, yeah, that was his view on me looking to preserve my fertility. But sort of I just pushed and said, look, is there a way of doing this without, you know, too high a risk to my own life and my health and well-being? And he said, look, that we do have options. You can go through IVF. I'll give you 14 days to go through, you know, an egg stimulation process and collect whatever is available. And after that, you know, that's it. You're in the chemo chair. So that's how, yeah. So that's how my own IVF journey sort of began and played out. And, you know, it ran concurrently to having had a mastectomy, being told I was diagnosed with cancer, hitting my 34th birthday, and just about to start chemotherapy.
Jesus. Oh my God. I mean, one of my questions was going to be, like, when you're facing potentially a kind of life and death situation, how important is the kind of the idea of infertility? Does it, you know, is it devastating, or is it just kind of almost secondary?
It's almost secondary. So it becomes part of your cancer treatment rather than part of actually creating a family or a life. Mm-hmm. I never went into it thinking that this was something brilliant and positive and, you know, something that could be a part of my future. It was very much you have to do this, it's a form of treatment. And then, you know, as we went through the egg collection process and the stimulation of and all the drugs, I was constantly sort of ping-ponging between am I crazy or is this wonderful? Because, you know, you'd have hope one day that actually I'm going to survive cancer and this all of this hard work that I'm putting in terms of my IVF treatment is going to make me a mum. And then the next day you'd be thinking, I have a hormonally sensitive cancer. I'm feeding it with these syringes of drugs I'm putting inside of me, and I'm never even going to live to see this child because I'd probably kill myself in the process of I'm doing. So it was and two of the biggest and hardest things, you know, you'll generally maybe go through in life, cancer and infertility, and to run them concurrently.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, it's, you know, anyone facing IVF, it's like a really big thing and like possibly the biggest thing that lots of people go through. And then for you to kind of, that almost to be like a sideshow to an even bigger thing.
Yeah.
And then having like a time stamp on it, like this got to be done within 2 weeks. I mean, fucking hell, that's incredible that you handled it. Was it just like something that, like almost tunnel vision, like I've got to just get through this kind of thing without?
I think so. And I think part of the blessing was a level of naivety, I guess, because I hadn't been on an infertility journey up until that point. So I didn't really know what IVF involved, and I didn't know how successful or unsuccessful it could be. It was just something we had to do. So I guess all of that knowledge I now have wasn't there. So I just did what I was told, you know, and went through it. But very much like I sometimes think, you know, a lot of couples come to a space of IVF treatment with hope, you know, thinking this is going to potentially be it when they first start off, thinking this hopefully will give us our baby. And I rarely felt hopeful when it came to that process. Like, you know, now I can look back on it and think, God, thank God I did, because ultimately I do have a child from that process. But
yeah,
you know, she wasn't born from this sort of mum and dad just desperately wanting a baby. She was born from all that I can say is an insurance policy.
Yeah, good planning.
Yeah, thankfully, sort of, you know. And I think, you know, it's important, like, you know, oncologists in the space of cancer at the moment, a lot of them are older men who just don't quite understand how important it is for young women to preserve their fertility or to have a route to motherhood, you know, to... It just means so much. And I think there's a lot of educating that needs to be done in that space that an oncologist doesn't say, my job's not to create a life, it's to, you know, to save a life. Because actually that has never left me since that day. And, you know, thank God, you know, I'm strong-willed enough to have just pushed for what was important to me. But there are some who don't, and some who will take the oncologist's view as gospel. And it's for them that I guess I do a lot of my advocacy work, and we launched our own podcast because I want people to know that there are options to motherhood after cancer, and, you know, it can be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, you know, we often talk on this podcast about how we wish medics in this country would take a kind of more holistic view. So they think about, you know, if you've got cancer, what's the knock-on effect of that to the rest of your life? So, and it's just another example really, isn't it? Anyway, I interrupted you.
Anyway, so that's I guess where we sort of found myself on sort of the fertility treatment train. And then you know, I went through that process. We ended up harvesting 12 day one embryos, and they were put in the freezer, and literally within days I was back into world of oncology, ready to sort of start chemotherapy. And I went through that process, which was as grueling as you would expect it to be. Came out the other side of that in 2014, and in 2015 went on to have sort of really quite aggressive surgery in terms of, you know, both my breasts were taken off and rebuilt using my own tissues. And that was at the back end of 2015, and into 2016 I recovered from that major surgery. And then went on holiday in 2016 to celebrate the end of life with cancer. And very quickly landed in Vancouver and started to feel really sick and unwell and unable to catch my breath and, you know, persistently coughing. And we sought sort of medical help over, you know, over the course of a couple of days, started sort of asking what I should do, and ended up in a walk-in centre. And a doctor referred me back to a general hospital and just said, look, we can't treat you here. You need to go to a hospital. It might be something quite serious. We suggest you get checked in and get someone to look over you. So I did that, went to one hospital who couldn't tell me what was going on, went to the next hospital, by which point I was in and out of consciousness. Couldn't really tell you what was going on too much. I sort of could see my husband in terms of a figure, but couldn't really make out his features and couldn't breathe. And was put into a room. Popped into a room, a bay on an A&E ward, and given oxygen, to which I didn't really respond. And, you know, then given some more sort of serious drugs and treatment, and had multiple teams come and visit me, none of whom could diagnose what was wrong with me. And it got to a point where they just said to my husband, look, she's acutely ill. We can't seem to stabilize her. We can't seem to saturate her blood oxygen levels. You know, we're struggling here to know what's wrong with her. And without knowing what's wrong with her, we cannot treat her. And at this moment in time, we suggest you say your goodbyes, because there's not much we can do at this point.
Oh my God.
And we were in Canada, thousands of miles away from home. And they said, look, and if there's anyone from the UK that you think should come and visit her before, you know, the inevitable may happen, we suggest you call them now. So my husband did that and called my sister over. And then the final team that came to my bedside was a team of cardiologists. And the guy said to me, look, I know you've been through it, a real rough couple of days and you can hardly speak. I just want you to squeeze my hand if the answer to my question that I'm about to pose is a yes. So he really gently just sort of knelt down and came to my ear and said, was your chemotherapy red in colour? And I squeezed his hand because I absolutely knew that, you know, even on my deathbed, I'll never forget the colour of my chemotherapy. And at the same time, someone was scanning my heart, and it was as if at the moment I squeezed his hand, it was like a scene out of ER, you know, someone pressed a red button behind my bed and this alarm went off, and a team of doctors ran into the room, and they just sort of, one of them just shouted, she's in acute heart failure, get her down to cardiac ICU now. Yeah. And so the rails went up on the side of the bed, and everything that was attached to me was sort of thrown onto the bed, and literally we were held down the corridor, and you know, my husband was just sort of running up behind me. We got into ICU. And were then told that, you know, I was in heart failure. And it was a really severe situation. My heart at the time was working at around about 6%. And they just didn't really understand how I was still alive and how I was still coherent, but I was still able to sort of roughly figure out what was going on. And then later on that day, a doctor came in, a consultant, and she just said, Karina, look, we've done a lot of investigating, and what we think has happened is that the chemotherapy you had in 2013 has slowly been damaging your heart. It's a rare but real side effect of one of the drugs you had, and you know, unfortunately, it seems to have happened to you, and now you're in this really difficult position of heart failure, acute heart failure, and we can't just make it better because you can't just fix the heart muscle like that. So we spent the next 2 weeks in ICU. We were told over and over that you know, we had to take each day as it came, and you know, there was no guarantee that I would live beyond the next 24 hours, 48 hours. But I did, and you know, sort of survived everything that they threw at me, and you know, slowly got onto the treatments that they gave me. And you know, it's a really long story, and this is covered on loads of other podcasts in a lot more detail, but ultimately ended up having to stay in Vancouver for 8 weeks until I could sort of get some sort of stability in my cardiac health. And then after that time, we were flown home to England with medical assistance. And we were moaning about, you know, England being a bit of a crappy place at the moment, but at that point in time, I didn't want to be anywhere else.
Oh my from God, here, I imagine.
The UK, home. And, you know, we made it, thankfully, got back home, and then got into the care of a really good cardio-oncologist, who is someone who specializes in heart disease after cancer. And, you know, together we sort of rehabbed ourselves. And, you know, I left Vancouver in a wheelchair. I couldn't really walk. I couldn't stand. And over the period of a year, probably, I, with medication and rehab and a heck of a lot of grit, went from, you know, being in a wheelchair to walking and talking and running and doing the normal things that I was doing pre-heart failure. But the consequence, I guess, the major consequence of heart failure was that I would never be able to carry a pregnancy. So that sort of full circled me back to my fertility journey. As I sort of had navigated from between 2013 to 2016, I'd always checked in with my oncologist and said, look, is pregnancy an option for me? And I was always told, you know what, it's too high risk to come off your drugs to try and get pregnant yet. Not yet, not yet.
So yeah, because they kind of put you in menopause, right, before your
exactly,
treatment.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So after 2014, when my active treatment ended, I was put into a medical menopause.
Yeah.
And the estrogen supply in my body was turned off.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no periods. So there was always that risk that if I came off my drugs, I would potentially you know, introduce estrogen into my body again and then risk a recurrence of cancer. And then heart failure came, and you know, that kind of just said, you know what, you're never going to be pregnant. You just need to say goodbye to that dream. And
that must be so hard. So you've had both your breasts removed, you've had the estrogen turned off, and now you're told you can't be pregnant. I mean, as a woman,
it's massive, and just, you know, it's
heartbreaking. Well, that's probably not the right term to use.
No, pardon the pun, but it absolutely is. And you know, it's just, you know, people say, you know, there's more to womanhood than your physical, you know, your breasts or your ability to have a baby. Of course there is. But actually, that's a massive part of you as a woman. Uh-huh. And, you know, I was never booby. Like, I never loved my boobs, but I was quite thankful to have boobs, you know. Like periods, you know, you hate them when you have them regularly every month, but when you can't have them, you crave them because they just remind you of how wonderful our bodies are and our body's ability to grow and nurture and create. And you know, if someone takes that away from you overnight at the age of 33, it's hard. It's a really harsh reality. So I guess I'd kind of looked into surrogacy through the end of my through sort of 2014 and 2015, as sort of my oncologist was saying, it's unlikely you're going to get pregnant. I was just like, I just want to be a mum, you know. I've got through this cancer treatment and I don't believe it's going to kill me. So I started looking into surrogacy, and then when heart failure came knocking, you know, surrogacy had to be the only way I was ever going to be a mum. And thankfully sort of I'd put a lot of work into sort of looking for a surrogate and being present in the independent surrogacy community.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like, can I just ask? So how do you kind of start and have become part of that community? Is it on social media or
what is that community?
Tell us more. I mean, there's a couple of ways of, you know, in the UK of becoming a parent through surrogacy. You could go through an agency. And agencies are set up, you know, various agencies do different things in terms of helping you match or introducing you to potential surrogates, or you can do it independently, which is what I did. Initially, I'd sort of gone down the agency route. I think that's quite a natural thing for people to do, think that they're a bit protected if they go through an agency. But sort of every time sort of we went to a couple of agency meetups and stuff, and my husband and I just didn't like the vibe. It just wasn't for us at all.
Okay.
And we're people of color, and we were grossly underrepresented in those agency spaces. And I think on top of that, we were approaching a point at which a lot of the agencies were starting to close their books because their ratios were out. A lot of agencies will say, do you know what, I'll only have like three sets of intended parents to one surrogate because I don't want to like oversaturate the sort of the market, I guess. And I didn't really like that because I just think from the beginning, I was like, this isn't about ratios and numbers. It's about hearts connecting. And like, I don't like that I'm just going to be, you know, told I can't join and might not meet one of their surrogates because I'm the wrong number in the queue. Like, I want to I want someone to know me for me, not the number I am on a wait list. So, I stumbled upon independent surrogacy actually through, a girl I'd met on a breast cancer forum, and she said, look, do you know what, before you sign a check, like, just look at independent surrogacy because it's very much the same as what a lot of the agencies do. It's not going to cost you any money and you're not going to lose anything. Like, you can always go back to the agency, but why don't you try doing it yourself? And I am one of those people who quite likes, you know, just exploring and finding my own way and stuff. So, you know, I just thought, okay, let me just give this a go. Like, the other way doesn't seem to be working for us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that involved joining some sort of closed private Facebook groups where actually there are wonderful communities like of surrogates and intended parents. And, you know, there are no ratios to worry about. It's just, you know, it's just about getting into those communities, getting people to know you for who you are, the journey you've been on, and what brings you to a place of surrogacy. And, you know, more than that, what makes you tick, like who you are as a person, aside from your disease or your illness or your infertility, like who are you and how can you connect with someone who gets on, you know, with you and who likes the same things you like and stuff like that. So,
and if somebody wanted to find out more about those, could they message you?
Yeah, they can. Like, so they can always message me on my Instagram, which is at Karina Demon. Or we've got basically our own podcast is called The Intended Parent, and that is an A to Z of how you start and end with independent surrogacy. So everything you need to know, from joining forums to what etiquette is and what expenses are and what the law is. And
that's brilliant.
Everything. So anyone who's looking into surrogacy, like, that is for me and Fran, who's my co-host, we would like call that Surrogacy for Dummies if there was a book on the shelf.
Because it's literally, that's what we like around here.
Basically,
sounds good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anything for dummies is good for us.
Absolutely, and it's gone down really well, and you know, we've helped so many people navigate their way through surrogacy. So super proud of that piece of work.
How did you find your first surrogate? Tell us about the meet cute. Is that what you call it?
Well, it is really like dating. So I had joined sort of 2015. I think I'd joined the forums and been very active on it, and you know, constantly hearing from my husband, "You spend too much time on your phone," blah blah blah. And I was like, well, do you know what? I'm actually doing some really good work here, because I'm making sure that people know me for me. Like, you know what? You know me, so you don't need my time right now. These people need to know me a bit better. So, you know, I worked really hard, I think, on those surrogacy pages in terms of making sure people had visibility of who we were and people knew our story. And we met up with a couple of ladies who didn't turn out to be our surrogates, and it's just for various reasons, you know, either their circumstances changed or we didn't quite click, or, you know, it just wasn't for us. And then we sort of rolled into 2016, and ironically, the first time I spoke to the wonderful woman who did end up being my surrogate was when I was in ICU in Vancouver.
Really?
She actually messaged me and she just said, look, I've been following you and reading your story, and I just, you know, I think you're awesome, and I just wondered if you wanted to chat more. And I remember messaging her back going, oh yeah, there's so much going on in my life. And she was a bit like, yes, it's crazy. And I was like, no, but seriously, like, right now I'm in intensive care. She was she was so funny. Like, she didn't actually care. Like, she was like, oh yeah, well, I hope you get over this incident soon and you actually get to enjoy some of Vancouver, and when you come back to England we can carry on talking some more. And like, she just didn't think I was gonna cock it regardless of what the doctors were
saying.
That
must have been quite good. It's like, oh, she doesn't think I'm
It was, and I think without even realizing it, she gave me so much hope. Like, that's so great. Much hope.
And also, she's from Bath, right?
Yes,
I'm from Bath.
I know,
all the best people are.
They really are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my daughter was born in Bath as well, so I'm massively biased.
Oh, are you eight? Yeah. Sorry.
So I started speaking to her in 2016, and then as I got back to England and got stronger, I just said to her, look, things are progressing well. If you want to carry on talking, like, I don't think I'm going to die either. So, like, I still want to be a mum. And so we did, and, you know, we chatted more. And then I think it was the end of 2016, like, my best friends had said, look, let's get away to like a really chilled out cottage break. And we actually went to Bath for this cottage, well, just outside of Bath. And she goes, let's just go, like, and it was just me and my girlfriends, you know, just enjoying time with each other. And then, like, it clicked to me that she was from Bath. So I just messaged her and just go, oh, me and my friends are actually going into the city centre tomorrow. If you're free, do you want to meet up for a coffee? And she was like, oh, I'm going anyway with my daughter, so perfect, let's catch up. And so that was the first time we met. And I think the different thing with Ina when I met her was that I think I knew from our very first conversation that this could go the distance, because her humility was just something else. Like, we walked into this coffee shop and we were just talking, and then she just said, look, one thing I need you to know is that if we get on and if we match, and, you know, if I ever was a surrogate for anyone, not you particularly, I wouldn't ever want to be put on a pedestal, because I strongly believe that I couldn't, well, I know that I couldn't do this without you or without an intended mother, and that this is a two-way street, you know, like I want to carry a baby for someone, but to do that, I need someone who can't carry a baby. So we're a level playing field. And I just found that really wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, and I say this all the time when people ask me questions, but I just think the intended mother, so the person like me, goes through so much trauma to get to a point of surrogacy. Like, you know, you have to have suffered quite a lot of grief and hardship to end up in the world of surrogacy as a heterosexual couple. And sometimes that intended mother's grief gets forgotten because what comes after is a pregnancy and a baby and the incredible thing that a surrogate has done for a family. And that becomes the most apparent thing. Like even now, people will say, oh, my God, you know, what a wonderful woman to carry those babies for you. And absolutely, surrogates are incredible human beings. But the resilience and the tenacity and the dignity of the intended mother who gives up everything that she's ever dreamt of in terms of carrying a baby, seeing a pregnancy test turn positive, you know, her husband feeling her baby kick inside her, like all of that is sacrificed to go on a surrogacy journey. And I think that needs so much recognition. And it felt like in that moment, she recognized all of that trauma and pain that had preceded that meeting. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And I think from that minute, I thought, you know, I really want you to carry my baby because you're just awesome, you know.
Yeah. I mean, she sounds incredible. So
She is. She's wonderful. So, yeah, then our partners met up and, you know, we got to know each other more and we took our time. I think it was probably nearly a whole year between sort of our very first conversation and then arriving at fertility clinic for embryo transfer.
Right.
So we took our time and we were both first timers, so we didn't want to rush it. And we wanted to get everything right. So we got to know each other. We went through sort of surrogacy agreements to make sure we were all on the same page and that, you know, there weren't any clangers that would sort of mean that actually this was a really bad match. So, you know, again, you'll hear more if you listen to our podcast, but you'll go through things like an agreement, which discuss things that actually husband and wife or, you know, male and female probably don't talk about before they try and have a baby.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what you're going to do if there's a miscarriage at any point in time, what you're going to do if there's a stillbirth at any point in time, what you're going to do if either of the parents die before the baby's born. You know, so many things to consider. Yeah. What would happen to a surrogate's family if the surrogate was to die during childbirth? Like,
oh my God.
You just have to talk about all these things. And so it's really important that the relationship is super strong and that there's honesty through every aspect of your conversation. You know, this isn't something that you can just sort of sail through without having some awkward and complex conversations. So we took a lot of time to make sure we were all aligned on all of that. And fortunately we were. And then in the summer of 2017, we decided to go for an embryo transfer with Ina. So the embryos that we'd created in 2013, pre-cancer, were shipped to our fertility clinic. And I think that's quite an important thing for people to know, that not all clinics will have a surrogacy license. And a lot of NHS clinics won't have a surrogacy license. So
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, I didn't know that until the time came. But you have to find a clinic that has a license for surrogacy. So we found one and transferred our embryos over to there and then thawed all of, I think we had 12 on ice, thawed them all and took them to day five and had four or five decent quality embryos, but one really strong sort of blastocyst that was picked out for transfer. And we transferred that into Ina. And then she obviously went home to her house and my husband and I had booked like a long weekend away just to sort of, we just had to get out of the country because we were like, we're going to go mad. Yeah. And we sort of just sit here thinking, you know, are we going to be parents and all of what's gone on? So we left for a few days and then came back to England on sort of the Monday. And I'd been calling into the clinic because our plan was that we had obviously transferred one embryo into Ina and the rest were going to be refrozen for a potential second journey. Or like, you know, if this failed, we would have a backup plan. And on the sort of Monday, I didn't hear from the clinic and hadn't heard from them despite sort of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday rolling past, and then on Tuesday I finally got through to them. And I just said, look, it's Mrs. Demand. I'm just calling because, you know, on Thursday we had this transfer and you were meant to call me on Thursday night about the embryos going back in the freezer and just need to know what's happening.
Yeah.
And the embryologist just sort of went on hold for a minute and then she came back and she goes, oh, Mrs. Demand, I think you might be confused. And I said, about what? She goes, oh, there was no, that none of your material was preserved, it all was your left material. To perish.
And what?
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So basically the four or so embryos that we thought would go back in the freezer weren't refrozen, and we weren't advised that they weren't. Yeah.
And they didn't think to tell you.
No. And they did, they just allowed them to perish rather than ask us if we wanted to refreeze them regardless of the grading and whatever else was going on with them. So we were heartbroken at that point in time. And like, you know, often people talk about grief when it comes to a story of pregnancy or, you know, early miscarriage and stuff like that. But I think there's a real conversation to be had for sort of embryo loss. Because yeah, for me,
yeah.
Those embryos were my, like, they were my life. Yeah, absolutely. They were my unborn children, you know. They were the things that gave me hope after, you know, when I was sort of going through cancer treatment and stuff. I always just thought, if I make it, I've got those, like, maybe babies there, you know. And the day we found out that they were gone, I remember I was at home on my own and I was in the hallway and I literally fell to the ground and just cried and cried and cried, thinking, how could you just throw them away? Like, there are babies that I've been dreaming about for years now. And we didn't know at this point if Ina was pregnant either. So we didn't know if the transfer had worked. And I remember my husband just trying to console me, saying, oh, it'll be okay. Don't worry. We'll find out our way. And my team had all told me that I wouldn't be able to harvest eggs again. And I remember turning around to my husband and just going, it's all right for you to say that, because you can bash one out and have a genetic child now. I can't. Like, if this doesn't work, that's it. I'm done. And that was sort of like the fear and the resent and all sorts of stuff that was just going around in my head. And a lot of it's frustration at arriving at this point, thinking, I didn't sign up for this. Like, this is not on my, like, this was never on my 5-year plan, you know, like, how did it come to this? And then, you know, we had to park that and I phoned Ina and I told her what happened and she was just so angry. And she just said, how could they do that? You know,
and
I think at that moment that she heard that news, the pressure on her must have been off the scale in terms of
enormous.
Like, it's a big deal to try and get pregnant for anyone, but then to try and ensure that this embryo sticks, you know, when that's the only embryo that was left. What she must have had to deal with. But, she, you know, the amazing woman that she is, picked herself up and, you know, she then, we'd always had this agreement that we weren't going to pee on sticks, which I now realise is the most ridiculous thing to say to a pregnant woman. But I said to her, Ina, don't do it. Just wait. We've got day 10 bloods. Yeah. So let's just wait for that. And behind the scenes, she was obviously peeing on sticks. And she was just, every now and again, she'd be like, I feel pregnant, Karina, I feel pregnant. And I was like, Ina, how can you feel pregnant like 5 days after the transfer? Like, obviously, I don't have a clue about this. But she was peeing on sticks. And then every now and again, she'd send me photos that I refused to download over WhatsApp because I just didn't want to believe her feeling pregnant was actually a thing. Yeah. And then after her sending like quite a few, I was like, oh, I'm just going to download them. And one of them I decided to download in Wix with my husband standing next to me. And he was like, do not talk to me about this. Like, yeah, Wix, the DIY store. And he's like, I don't care what you and Ina talk about. I do not want to be a part of it. We've said day 10 blood test. That's all we're going to go for. I'm going to wait it out. And you two, just, if you're talking, just don't include me in the conversation. So then we were standing in Wix and this picture comes up on my phone and it was a very clear positive pregnancy test.
Oh my God.
And
honestly,
like, I can't remember if I was buying a light bulb or a screwdriver or whatever crap.
Were you in like the MDF aisle? Were you...
Yeah, we were at the checkout actually. We were at the checkout and like, I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I'm looking at Sati and he's looking at me like, who are you talking to? It's Ina, and he's looking at me and he's like, don't talk to me. And I've told you, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. And like, so he won't even look at the picture on my phone that I'm trying to show him. And I was like, oh my God, is this how you celebrate finding out you're potentially pregnant by your husband refusing to look at the picture? Like, what is going on?
It sounds quite classic. It sounds like a classic.
Yeah, probably.
Scenario.
Yeah. So, like, we got through that day. And then the next day, like, so Ina then knew that I had seen this picture and like I was starting to get excited. And then the next day she did a clear blue test. And I like I'd never seen a digital pregnancy test. I didn't know what it looked like. I didn't know what it would tell you. So she must have peed on the stick and recorded the whole thing. I think she had to do it twice because she dropped it down the toilet the first time.
So, I'm sure
it
happens a lot.
She did it the second time. And then, yeah, she sent me this video and I watched it and I was like, oh my God, it says the word pregnant. Like somehow that means more than two lines. I was like, shit, it's telling me I am pregnant. Like we're going to have a baby. God. And then it says like, and then afterwards it gives like 2 to 3 weeks. And I was like, oh my God, oh my, like, could this be happening? And I was at home on my own and I was like, oh my God, he's got to believe me now. Like he's got to believe me. But he still didn't want to know. The next day we were in the clinic for our day 10 bloods and I said to Ina, like, obviously this is just for us by now. Like me and her were like, oh my God, this is really happening. And the bloods were just sort of the confirmation or sort of the crossing of the T. So we went along and you know, we thought, yeah, they said they did a blood test and then we got the results and they said she's pregnant and, you know, everything's looking brilliant and would repeat the bloods tomorrow to check her hormone levels and so far so good. And I just couldn't believe our luck. Like, yeah. I couldn't believe that after everything that we'd been through that we'd actually get pregnant the first time round and that would be our only embryo and it would take and we'd get this positive pregnancy result. And oh, it was just mind-blowing. So that day after the blood results were in, I went home and I put together a little box for my husband to sort of break the news to him, and I printed out a picture of the clear blue test and I'd put gone to town and bought a little sleep sack that just said, you know, an adventure is about to begin, and popped it in a box and
so
just
cute.
You know, a couple of little tokens. Yeah, and I think part of that is like, as a woman, I was trying to compensate for what I couldn't do in terms of like, you know, naturally getting pregnant in any way myself, or, you know, I just wanted to do something to mark that moment in a different way to what we'd expected, but something that was equally special. Mm-hmm. So we did that, and you know, I gave him this box, and then of course there were loads of tears, and you know, it was beautiful. And the rest of that sort of journey went out, played out, and you know, we went to the next scan. So Ina and I went to a 6-week scan and we saw the heartbeat, and we were both blown away because she'd never had an early scan, obviously I'd never had a scan, and we just saw this little light flickering on the screen, and oh my God, like, I just couldn't believe it. And even now, like, I just, that video is like the most played video on my phone, and sometimes I just go back and just watch it and like listen to my voice and her voice and just think, geez, like, we made that baby, we did that together. So our pregnancy progressed, and then, you know, we spent a lot of time together and we watched Amala grow inside Ina, and we had lots of scans and it was just wonderful. And in April of 2018, Ina went into labor. We'd moved up to a little cottage just outside Bath to be near her in case she went into labor, and you know, we didn't want to have to drive 2.5 hours up, so we were close by. And then, you know, after quite a complex start to her delivery, we ended up in theatre. Amala was a bit dry, so they were saying that she would either have to be C-sectioned out or forcepsed out. And at the time, sort of, Ina and I always had said in our agreements that if ever we had to go to theatre, it would be Ina and myself who would go in. Sort of at that point, we'd been through a lot, and Ina was struggling, and I just said to her, look, you don't need me, you need your partner, you know, I'll wait outside, you know, you need support right now, it's not about me. And so her partner got ready to go, and then a midwife sort of looked at me and obviously was like, God, you're the mom, you need to be there. So she went and spoke to a consultant who just said, yeah, let her in, let two people go into theatre, and dad can wait in into the recovery room. So the three of us, Ina, myself, and her partner, went into theatre, and I could see Sati on the other side of recovery, just crying, like by the curtain, God. Just crying. And yeah. luckily one of the midwives who had been with us for a couple of days by this point saw him, and aww. she went up to the consultant. She goes, like, "That's not right, Dad. Look at him, he's over there." And the consultant was like, "Oh, just get him in. Come on, let's get everyone in." So
that's great. You know,
it was amazing. He got scrubbed up, and like within 2 minutes, he was in scrubs and sat next to me. And that moment before Amala was born was just perfection. Like, Ina was there, her partner was there, myself and Sati, the four people who had worked to bring this baby to life. Because it's not about just a woman, like an intended mother and a surrogate. It's about the whole support network. And yeah. we were all there. And then Amala came into the world, and, you know, they lifted her up, and we saw she was a little girl. And like, I could replay that moment over and over in my head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, never get tired of it, because, you know, at that moment I became a mum for the very first time against all odds. And this incredible woman in front of me had delivered this beautiful, beautiful baby girl for me. And, oh, God, it's just the thing of dreams, really. Nothing short of that.
But that's not the end of your story, right?
It's not the end of my story. So
there's another twist.
There's a very, yeah.
Well, there's a couple twist. More twists.
So yes, obviously, you know, Amala is now a beautiful 3-year-old, and she's wonderful. But I think from early on in her journey, we decided we wanted a second child. We knew it would be quite difficult because I wasn't able to collect eggs again. So we knew we'd look for a donor egg. And like that wasn't a decision we came to overnight. I personally had to do a lot of work on that, thinking, you know, how will I mother a child that's genetically mine and then another that's not genetically mine? And like, just wanted to make sure I was comfortable with that decision. And I come, like I said, from the South Asian community where people don't really do this. Like, you know, mm-hmm. surrogacy was a big thing in my community. And then to then go for donation, that's a massive thing. But we decided that's what we were going to do. And then, you know, in the UK, we really struggled to find anywhere that had any sort of donor agencies that had donors of colour. And that
yeah, was which is a common problem, right?
Yeah, no, like minorities are we're just not there yet in terms mm-hmm. of the, helping other people create families. So after a long search, I ended up choosing to go overseas and actually choosing known egg donation. And that was sort of a decision I came to for two reasons. One, because I wasn't going to carry this child. I kind of wanted to have a connection of some sort to the woman who gave me the egg for that child. I just wanted to meet her and say to her, like, you know, I'm not going to carry this egg that you're going to give us. Someone else is going to do that. But this is my family you're creating. And I just want you to know that this means the world to me. And like, you know, I don't take what you're doing for granted at all. And I wanted to be able to then tell my children that, you know, I know you're not my genetics, but I met the woman who is your genetics, and she was wonderful. Mm. And, you know, we spent this time before you were conceived, we spent time together and stuff. And so we chose that. So we did known egg donation, which meant we traveled to Cyprus for our treatment, and we flew a donor in from South Africa. So she came from South Africa. We flew from England. We harvested her eggs, fertilized with my husband, and put them in the freezer in Cyprus. And the hope was that Ina would go again and carry for us. But Ina had a change in circumstance quite soon after that collection and embryo freezing process. Right. And she sort of wasn't able to carry for us again. And I had to go out and find another surrogate, which I mean, was that's really daunting. And
not an easy job, right?
No, and especially because we'd spent so long thinking that we were matched, so I hadn't sort of really contemplated what it would be to go and find a surrogate again. And I'd created this really romantic notion that my two children would come from this, you know, would be carried by the same woman and stuff. So it was difficult, but you know, at the end of the day, I wanted motherhood more than anything, and so went out and did that. And fortunately, by that time, like, you know, the surrogacy community, the independent surrogacy community, is honestly beautiful, and I love it to bits. And the work that we'd done on our podcast and the advocacy that we'd been doing and I'd been doing, I think sort of stood me in really good stead within the community, and like a lot of my surrogate friends were then sort of pimping me out almost to surrogates who are new to the scene. Like, if you are looking for some IPs, me. You know, like these guys are good. Like, and it's just lovely to sort of have that. And it, so I actually ended up meeting Laura, our second surrogate, through a friend who is a surrogate, and who really supported me in my first journey. And Laura was a good friend of hers, and we got on very well because we had this mutual friend. And I think trust builds a lot easier when someone you trust has introduced you. And you know, we were both sort of not novices, and you know, we started talking in September, October of 2019, and by January we were matched, and by February we were on a plane to Cyprus going for embryo transfer. You know, that wasn't our plan. Like, our plan, I had planned to sort of, once we matched, I said to her, let's go in April and the weather will be nice and it'll be a much nicer flight. And she just said, can we go earlier, because I don't really want to be pregnant, heavily pregnant at Christmas time. So I was like, okay, that's like, you want to go in 4 weeks, but yeah, okay, we can make that work, like if we need to. And we moved mountains to do that, but thank God we did, because, you know, if we didn't go out in February, we would never have gone out because of the pandemic.
Of course.
Yeah. It wouldn't have ever happened. So we went out, and we had this conversation with the consultant, and we talked about embryos and what we were doing in terms of transfer. And you know, I said, how many would you recommend we transfer? And he said, well, I recommend you transfer two, because if you transferred one at this point in time, my guidance would be, you've got a 60% chance of a singleton pregnancy, 40% chance of no pregnancy. If you transfer two, you've probably got an 80% chance of a singleton pregnancy and a 20% chance of a twin pregnancy. And we were all happy to take that 20%. You know, twin pregnancy chance, like that was absolutely fine. We discussed it. Mm-hmm. So we went with two, and then we came home to England a couple of days later, and Laura sort of said to me, so what is it you want to see in terms of pregnancy tests? Like, what is it? And we knew that we wouldn't have that same sort of go and get the bloods done scenario together, because it just logistically wasn't possible, and there were mumblings of COVID going on. So I just said, look, if you get a test that looks like, I think a digital test, like with Amala, that was the one that really sealed it for me. So if you know, when you get to that point where we're sort of 7 or 8 days post-transfer and you want to do a clear blue but digital, that's fine. And she was like, okay, cool. And then literally within 2 days, she sends me some photos. I was at my mum's, and she sent me some photos, and she goes, I'm just going to send you the holiday snaps and, you know, take a look at your leisure. And I thought, okay, cool. So I made my mum and I a cup of tea. My mum didn't know we'd been to Cyprus. We sort of wanted to do this totally on our own. So we'd been and come back without anyone knowing. And then I went through these photos, and it was like Laura and I on the beach, Laura and I in the apartment, you know, going to the clinic. And then the very last picture was a positive clear blue pregnancy test.
Oh my God.
Like, oh my
God. What is it with these people sneaking up photos on you?
Honestly, like these sneaky pictures. And then, like, I didn't tell my mum. No, and I didn't want to tell my mum, because like Sati and I wanted to be, you know, us to know first, and for the pregnancy to progress to a point before we started sharing it with people. So I just was sat there like the Cheshire cat, like the cat who's got the cream, thinking, oh my God, my mum's gonna wonder what's going on here. But she was fine. And then I went home and I created another one of these surprise boxes, and I bought a letterboard and just wrote on it, you know, big sister duty begins November 2020. And when Sati came home from work, Amala was holding this letterboard, and he was just like, no, it can't be. We can't have lucked out again and got pregnant first time. And I was like, no, we have. And, you know, and I don't take that.
You deserve it though. You deserve that luck. Yeah, man.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I don't take it for granted. You know, I know how lucky and how fortunate we were, and it doesn't play out that way for everyone. But
listen, no one is begrudging you that.
Yeah. But wait, we haven't heard the twist yet.
And then, yes. So basically, got to a point. I think it was 5 or 6 weeks, and Laura was in hospital for her early scan. She had a few pains and niggles, so she wanted to get checked out.
And you were like, "Is it twins or is it singleton?"
Well, no, we actually were worried it was ectopic.
Oh, okay.
So actually, we were really afraid that we'd like have to lose, you know, that actually we weren't pregnant, because we were so scared that something had gone wrong. So she went to this scan, and I just thought, oh God, I hope it's okay. And then she phones me and says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm just working. And she goes, are you sitting down? And I thought, oh, God, she's going to tell me it's bad news. She's going to tell me it's bad news. And then she goes, don't swear. I'm going to tell you something. Don't swear. And I was like, oh, God, okay. And then I was like, go on then, just say it. And then she goes, you're having triplets. And I was like, what the fuck? And she's like, I told you not to swear. And I was like, how can you tell me not to swear when you just told me I'm having triplets?
Like, my family's about to quadruple in size.
Like, I can't actually understand what the hell is just that, like, that wasn't in the 80-20 he spoke about. There was never a triplet percentage.
There was no statistic for that.
There definitely wasn't, but that's what it was. And then, you know, we found out at 6 weeks that we were having triplets. So I when Satty came home that day from work, I put a little thing on the board saying, you know, congratulations, it's a demand party of six. And he read it and you could just see the maths, like six. There's three babies, triplets. It's like, uh-huh. And he's like, no, you're lying to me. And I was like, no, I'm serious. And I think initially, like, when someone tells you having triplets, like, the fear of God goes through you, because you think, how the hell am I going to cope with this? And, you know, I think Laura was quite afraid that we would ask her to reduce that pregnancy, because actually academically on paper we thought twins was the maximum we could deal with. But the, you know, the moment we, Satty and I both found out it was triplets, there was never any doubting that we would go the distance. You know, we were never going to interfere with what those babies wanted to do, and if they chose us for their parents, then that is exactly who we would be for them.
And she was okay with carrying them.
She wanted to carry them so badly, and you know, her team, her medical team kept telling her to reduce the pregnancy because it was so high risk. And she was like, I'm not reducing this, like, I don't want to reduce it, the parents don't want to reduce it, so we're not reducing it. And she ended up changing teams to make sure she had a supportive team around her.
Okay.
And we always had a, you know we were very aware that it was a high risk pregnancy, and we, none of us were sort of rose tinted glasses. We knew that there was always a risk that we might lose a baby somewhere along the line, or, you know, someone might not make it. And we, we always said, you know, if that happens, we deal with it. Like, if we lose one of these three, we deal with it together. And we went through the pregnancy, and, you know, we're in this COVID world, so there was very little contact between us, sort of physical contact.
That must have been hard.
Yeah, very hard, very hard. And, you know, like, I was reading all of the stuff that was going around online about partners not being allowed to scans and, you know, missing out on those special moments. And I was just sitting here thinking, what about the intended mother who doesn't get to go to her own baby scan? And what about the fact that actually these parents never feel or see that baby until the day it's born, because it doesn't come home with them? Like, you know, like, yeah, a partner might not get to go to a scan, but when that wife or that partner, you know, or the other half of, you know, the couple comes home, at least you can feel their tummy, or you can feel a baby kick, or, you know, that baby's there. But for us, it was like, this baby's, you know, 100 miles away, and we don't have any contact with it. And then at the 20-week scan, I did go. We'd sort of, Laura had arranged it with the hospital and just said, look, you have to let her in. She's the mum. And so I went to the 20-week scan, and, you know, it was incredible, but it actually highlighted to me how much I'd not been able to do this myself. And I didn't really feel that with Amala, because I felt very involved in the whole pregnancy. But with the triplets, because we weren't there much, and because there were three of them, and Laura was scanned every 2 weeks, she knew everything about them. You know, she knew which baby was where, and where the head was, and where the legs were. And I was a bit like Rachel in Friends, you know, when you look at the screen, and I was just like, I don't know what I'm looking at. I just do not know what I'm looking at.
Well, there's,
you know,
a lot of people in there. They're probably quite tangled up, I imagine.
A lot of tangled up limbs. And and you know, the sonographer, you know, I think this is another thing, like, the sonographer will typically just speak to the person who's pregnant and just say, look, here's a leg and here's an arm. And you're very much on the outside. And I felt that as an intended mother, just sort of trying to figure it out, you know. And that's not through anyone's fault, like, you know, Laura absolutely was keeping me involved, but it just highlighted what I hadn't done for myself. So you know, so that was sort of bittersweet, that scan. And then we arranged one more private scan for Satty to see the babies before they were born, because we just thought, God, you know, like, we're getting to 24 weeks and we just need him to see them, because if they come at any point after this, you know, he will never have seen them inside her. So we did one more scan, and we took my daughter Amala with us to that one, and she was the cutest. Aww. And just kept saying, oh, my babies are in Lawler's tummy, my babies are in Lawler's tummy. And aww, you know, so I'm actually really proud of that. Yeah, because yeah. I think it's really important to sort of raise a generation who don't think it's unusual for someone else to carry a child if that's absolutely. What's needed.
Yeah.
So she's, you know, she's really familiar, and she'll say, oh yeah, Marla was in Ina's tummy and my brothers were in Lawler's tummy and mummy's tummy was broken, but now it's better. And like, she just needs to think that everything's better, so she thinks okay. it's better.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course.
But yeah, so that happened. And then at 30 weeks, Laura went into natural labor. And she phoned me and she just said, Queena, the babies are coming. It was 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, the 23rd of August. And we Satya and I whizzed up the motorway, got to the hospital, and just said to the lady at the foyer, like, you know, we're the parents of the triplets that have been born via surrogacy. And the woman just said, who? And I said, we said, we're the parents. And she just couldn't, I don't know, she was either being obtuse or being dumb.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, that's our baby, our surrogate's giving birth to our babies. And she just looked at me and she just went, have you been COVID tested? And I said, no, it's a spontaneous labor. Did you ask the woman giving birth if she's been COVID tested? Like, oh, seriously. And she just said, well, you can't go any further because you've not been COVID tested. And I said, she hasn't been COVID tested. Like, every other woman who's having a child here hasn't been COVID tested. Like, you can't not let me in. And she said, no, you can't go any further because you're clearly not giving birth and you haven't had a COVID test.
Jesus. Fucking COVID.
Yeah. And she said the same to Satin. We were just a bit gobsmacked. And then, like, I said to her, look, rather than argue, like, you know, I've got a phlebotomist coming. We planned to harvest stem cells. So I said, you know, they just need to know where they're coming. She's COVID tested. Tell me where she needs to go. And she goes, oh, I don't understand why you would need a phlebotomist. I said, because we're harvesting stem cells from either the umbilical cord or the placenta. And then she goes, it's not available. The placenta is not available. And I said, well, we use the umbilical cord then. And she goes, that's not available. And I looked at her and I was like, what are you talking about? And then, like, it was a bit like the cogs turning in my head. And I looked at her and I said, where's the placenta? Is it not with Laura? And she goes, no. I said, so if the placenta is not with Laura, are you telling me the babies are here already? And she looked at me and she goes, did you not know that? And that's how we found out that the babies were born.
Oh, my God.
Having this argument with this woman in the foyer.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What a bitch.
So we both broke down in tears and just sort of were bawling our eyes out. And I just said to her, like, did they all make it? That, you know, we knew it was 30 weeks. I said, are they all okay? And she just goes, I can't tell you anything.
Oh, fuck off.
I shouldn't have even told you that they were born. And I just said, look, I've got my birth plan here. I am we are the parents of these children. And then she goes, you can't do anything until you're COVID tested. So I said, well, can you swab us now? And it was like 6:30 in the morning. She goes, oh, we're quite busy. Could you come back at 11? I was like, I've just driven 2 hours up the motorway. And you're too busy to swab me. And she goes, tell you what, there's a McDonald's down the road. Why don't you go there, have a coffee and come back at 11 and I'll do your swab then. And I just thought, would you tell any other brand new parents to premature triplets to go to McDonald's and have a coffee because you haven't got time to swab them? You know, it was just ridiculous. So eventually sort of we left that foyer unswabbed, and then, you know, various things happened and we sort of ended up getting swabbed by sort of, I think it was about 8-9 in the morning, they swabbed us. And then they still said, though, we're not letting you in until these results come back, and that's going to take between 6 to 8 hours. And I just thought, and in between, one nurse had come up to us and said, just want you to let you know that all three of your babies survived and they're in the neonatal unit. So we knew that the boys, well, we didn't know they were boys. We knew the babies were in the neonatal unit. We knew that Laura was resting up and, you know, she'd had an emergency C-section, but she was doing okay. And then we had nothing to do apart from wait for these results. So we just got in the car and drove back down the motorway home and then saw Amala, and after an hour or so drove back in the motor, went back in the car up the motorway to go back to Northampton once the results were in. And it was 12 hours sort of from the point at which we first arrived to the point at which we got to go in and see Laura and the boys. And we went to Laura's bedside first to check how she was and for her to tell us, you know, what happened. And, you know, let's not forget that this incredible woman had had to give birth to triplets on her own because no one was allowed to go in with her, which was just disgusting.
Wow.
And, you know, she was okay, but she had no one. And I just thought, God, that's so cruel. I was literally outside the door and I wasn't able to be with you, you know. I'm the mother of those children and you birthed them and I wasn't allowed to be with you. And then, you know, she told me and Sati that we had three sons. Oh, we couldn't believe it. Like, we just could not believe it. And we cried some more. And then we went up to the neonatal unit and just walked into this room where the boys were. And that we were quite fortunate in that because COVID had sort of restrictions on the number of babies allowed in a room. And this room had a maximum of two babies from separate households could be in this room. But obviously we had three babies from one household, so we had one room to ourselves.
Right.
And we just walked into that room and just split up. You know, Sati went to one side, I went to the other side, and just drank in these three tiny, tiny little human beings who were our tiny little boys. They were so fragile and, God, we were so afraid to pick them up. But, you know, over time we sort of did learn to sort of look after them and to pick them up and to feed them and to change their nappies. And, you know, I think, you know, when you get over sort of how frustratingly annoying that sort of initial period of getting to them was, once we got in there, we were treated as their parents and no one else, you know, no one treated us as anything else. And we were the most important things when it came to their care and the most important people in their lives. And actually, they ended up being in neonatal for 8 weeks from the day they arrived to the day they were discharged. And for me, I like to look at that as an extension of a pregnancy that I was allowed to be a part of. Yeah. And that's absolutely how I see it. Like, those Perspex boxes were just like a womb and someone else's womb, but I was able to go in and feed them and hold them and they could get to know me. And actually it was brilliant because then when they came home, we were the only people they knew as their parents. And
And
it was magical, but God, it was really hard to get there. And, you know, the whole journey was just so difficult and so full of emotion and, oh, adversity, you know, every turning there was something going on. But we made it. And, you know, look, I sit here today, like, you know, mum of one 3-year-old.
Mum of four.
Yeah.
Karina.
Yes.
I mean, we could keep talking to you forever because this is, I mean, the most unbelievable story. But thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
Hey, guys. Welcome back.
Welcome back for the next minute or so.
Yes, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I also hope that you enjoyed it. What a story Karina has.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Yeah. Who are we talking to next week, Gabriella?
We're speaking to Annabelle Wyatt, aka Maybe Hood, from Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Aka mother of the Tilda Beast, the famous cat.
Another classic BFN digression.
Yes, and we're not just talking to her about her famous cat, although we do talk about her famous cat.
Yes.
And we're also talking about her state of maybehood, which is an interesting word. I think it's quite a good one.
It is a great word. It's and what childlessness, not by choice, means to her, whether she even defines herself as that. It was quite an emotional chat, wasn't it?
Quite an emotional one, yeah. Get to see the back of the throat again.
Yeah.
But also, she's lovely. And she swears a lot, which is always a good thing in my book. So, big tick from Gabby. Or Jizzy G, as we're now calling me.
Big tick from Jizzy G.
Right. I better trademark that as quickly as possible, right? If someone else gets it, it's going to be a good one, so make sure you tune in. And until then, have a fantastic week.
Yeah, see you later.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.